You're listening to the Gut Biome Podcast, where we take a functional
and evidence-based
approach to gut health. In a world filled with conflicting opinions, we understand that navigating gut health can be challenging. That's why we're here to help.
I'm Dr. Dan, a gastroenterologist in training.
And I'm Greta Rose, a functional nutritionist. With over 20 years of combined clinical and hospital experience, we're here to break down the latest research and deliver practical and easy to understand solutions. Welcome back to the Gut Biome Podcast.
Welcome back.
I feel like it's been a while since we've jumped on here. Life has chucked so many big whirlwinds in for us.
Such as a ring.
Yes, Dan and I have gotten back from incredible South Africa on safari, and the romantic man, found his knee halfway through a safari with animals and elephants and giraffes and hippos, and I had no choice but to say yes.
Oh, that's the ring we're talking about. I thought we were talking about something to do with the gut.
No. So out of the bag, Dan and I are very excitedly engaged. It's a very, very fun chapter in our life.
So apologies for the delay, yes. But here we are.
Yes, here
ready
we are.
Ready to fill your ears with tales of constipation.
Yeah. And this is a really interesting topic because, Dan, remember when I said to you, let's have a chat about constipation, and you turned around and was like, oh, that'll be a really easy one. And that, you saying that, was the number one reason that wanted me to do this, because constipation is far from easy and it's far from simple if you actually want to treat the root cause of it. So I'm super excited to delve in.
Let's start with a case.
Yeah, a case study. Okay, what's the worst? What do you think the worst constipation you've ever seen in hospital?
It was an elderly lady who was so constipated that she tore her bowel.
Ooh.
She was unfortunately an elderly lady with dementia who probably hadn't drank anything in terms of water for probably 10 days or so. And she was admitted with perforation of the bowel, which is where the bowel itself gets cut by your own feces. Your own feces can get that hard that it becomes so hard, it becomes like a pebble with sharp edges that can cut through the bowel. So she needed emergency surgery. We call that a stercolith or a fecolith when it becomes that hard.
Gosh. But do you think her bowel was, like, the bowel lining was potentially already on the very delicate end?
Not particularly, but as we'll talk about, with age, your gut tends to slow down. So she already had predisposing factors, and then add on top of that the dementia and the lack of awareness to drink every day.
Sure.
And the lack of awareness that she hasn't been to the toilet for a few days and do something about it.
Because, look, I get some very constipated people that come into my clinic and, oh, gosh, I couldn't imagine a bowel perforation happening from it.
Oh, this is extremely rare. I don't mean to scare you, but this is what could happen.
Yes. Well, hopefully by the end of our podcast, we will save many a constipation patients, and it will be a thing of the past.
And an ICU bed.
All right. Well, let's talk about a bit of a framework for today's chat. So what I really wanted to go through was a bit of a background on constipation, because I've got some big opinions about that.
As you already heard.
Also how to test for constipation. Also got some very big opinions about that. How to treat constipation from a medical and a functional point of view. And then also some other things that I think is worth people to consider when they're thinking about constipation. And then also, Dan, I've got a couple of questions for you right at the end that I often have clients coming to me asking, and I would love your opinion on.
Sounds amazing. And as always, stick around till the end to hear your favorite tune.
Why don't we jump into the background of constipation? I'm going to start off by calling out the Rome criteria for constipation. Fewer than 3 bowel motions per week, hard stool more than 25% of every bowel motion, or a sense of incomplete evacuation. So that basically means when you go to the bathroom, you feel incomplete more than 25% of the time.
And we're not talking about how you feel in yourself in terms of being incomplete. We're talking about whether you feel you need to go a second time
yes.
to defecate.
Yes.
Because otherwise, there'll be a lot of people writing in.
So what do you think about, what's your opinion about that diagnosis? Are you happy with that diagnosis criteria?
Yeah, most of the time in hospitals, at least, we make our diagnosis clinically. So that's just based on talking to the patient with or without evidence from maybe a stool chart. And that's how we make our diagnosis of constipation most of the time.
When you say stool chart, are you talking about the Bristol stool chart?
Just the frequency of how often people say they go.
Frequency,
and,
yeah.
And what that looks like. It doesn't necessarily need to be as complicated yet as what the stool itself looks like. We can gather that info from the patient. But if we want to go in more detail, then we start talking about the Bristol stool chart. If you want to have some fun, look up the Bristol stool chart. And if you want to have more fun, look up the Bristol stool chart chocolate version.
Chocolate version, oh my gosh.
And really...
Never going to see a picnic in the same way.
And I hope you're not eating, because we have to talk about this in detail. But it's a scale that goes from 1 to 7. 4 is a normal sausage, and then it gets more constipated all the way to type 1. Type 1 is little pellets, a little bit like rabbit stool. If you're having little pellets, then you know you are getting very constipated.
Yeah. Okay. Should we save that for how to test for constipation, because the Rome criteria will be great for a testing tool. But what I really wanted to know is, are you okay with patients coming in and having a bowel motion every second day?
Look, it's quite common, and if that's normal for the patient, then that's fine by us generally.
Okay, I don't agree. I really think that diagnosis of fewer than 3 bowel motions a day, so there's 7 days in the week, and that's every other day, and then missing a day on the weekend as well.
Yeah, it's not optimal. I used to work for a surgeon when I was in medical school. He was a colorectal surgeon, so he's extremely paranoid about this.
Yeah.
He would break up his surgeries to go and defecate.
Nice. Oh, my gosh. If I could tell all my patients to do that.
So he would go fantastic. At least twice a day, maybe 3 times a day.
Yeah.
I think that's a bit too much. But going once a day is really good.
Yes.
If you can go every 1.5 day, then I still think you're onto a winner.
No, sorry, don't agree again. I want everyone going every single day with a good, complete bowel motion. And that is so achievable with the right routine and the right rhythm. I get if people are traveling or they miss their window of opportunity, or I don't know, they eat something that's slowed their gut down. I get that happens. That's life. But 90% of people's lives, I want them to have a good, complete bowel motion every single day. And the reason I say this is because all of the patients that I have worked with that go to the bathroom every second day, they also have gas and bloating and really foul-smelling stools. It's not just the constipation they've got. It's all of the other symptoms. And 100% of my patients, if I can get them to a point where they're going to the bathroom every day, all of those symptoms will disappear.
They improve. And I guess this is the reason why we're talking about this topic. We're talking about the risks of constipation and what the problems is.
Yeah.
The problems are with having constipation. From a medical point of view, the usual risks that we worry about are the development of hemorrhoids as you get older, which are bulging blood vessels towards your anus, which can bleed. They can sometimes clot off. They can become painful. there is some arguments in the literature about how diverticular disease happens. They're little side alleys in your last part of the large bowel, and the little outpouchings that develop. And it's not quite clear why they develop. If somebody knows, they can probably win a Nobel Prize, because they can cause disease. Bacteria and feces can get stuck in them. They can get inflamed. Then you have diverticulosis, diverticulitis, instead of just diverticulosis. Although there's still argument about whether this is caused by constipation or something else, but especially white Westerners tend to develop this as they get older. And then, as we already implied, if your constipation gets terribly bad, you can get fecal impaction, and in extreme cases, very rarely, perforation.
Yeah, that's it from a medical point of view. And from a functional point of view, we get huge disruptions in the microbiome when we have stool just sitting there, because every bowel motion you have, you're basically sweeping out and moving the bacteria through. So if everything's just stagnating there and not moving, then we just get, we call it a bloom of bacteria.
And we see that in our liver patients. So generally most patients, they're probably not sensitive enough for us to notice that difference. But in our liver patients who can't process the usual bacteria that grow in their gut and the side products that these make, they get extremely confused from this. The confusion, the side products, the toxins, they start affecting the brain, and they get something called hepatic encephalopathy, liver confusion. And it's very hard to recover from. So with our liver cirrhosis, our liver failure patients, we get them to poo at least 2 to 3 times a day to stop this from happening.
2 to 3 times a day. Gosh, that's solid. I don't think I could do that.
Well, it's not solid.
I'm a one time a day gal. What are you?
One and a half. Yeah.
Everyone, can I just explain, on Dan and I's first date, when we figured out that we were both weirdly obsessed with the gut, I remember I turned around to Dan and I said, do you remember what I asked?
No, I do not.
Turned around and I was like, how are your bowel motions?
That's the weirdest chat up line I've ever heard.
Yeah, but it worked, right?
I was not freaked out.
You put a ring on it.
Did you have love hearts in your eyes when I answered?
So funny. Hilarious. All right. Well, let's have a quick chat about how to actually test for constipation. And can you, let's bring back up that Bristol stool chart, because in my opinion, I think it's quite 2D. And I think there's a big part of constipation testing that is missed. So do you want to explain to people listening, how the Bristol stool chart works, and what the ideal stool you're looking for?
Yeah, the ideal stool is a sausage lump with or without cragginess in it. So a smooth sausage lump is probably the ideal. If there's some cragginess in it, it starts to get more constipated. And if you get smaller hard lumps all the way to the pellets we talked about, then you're probably constipated. Ideal with a much more older population on the wards in hospital. And what often happens is they will suddenly have diarrhea, and you'll ask them, okay, you have diarrhea at the moment. What do you mean with that? And they say, oh, very loose stool. And I ask, how often does it happen? And they say, oh, maybe once a day. And that kind of triggers me in my mind to go, that doesn't sound like, you know, an infection. You 4 or 5 times a day. And then you ask them, okay, so before the diarrhea started, when did you last open your bowels? And they go, oh, 1 or 2 or 3 days before that. And then I ask them, okay, what did it look like? Was it pellets? Mm-hmm. And they inevitably go, yes. And what that is overflow diarrhea, which is this crazy thing where instead of having little pellets and knowing you're constipated, you go a couple of days without opening your bowels because you've become so constipated. And then all of a sudden, all that comes out is liquid, as the stool has to force its way around these pellets that are still stuck somewhere. And people don't realize that they need to treat that with emergency laxatives, because they go, oh, I've got diarrhea. And this is the kind of stuff that happens in elderly patients when they sit on a ward for several days.
And would you use an enema for something like that?
Yes, we'll use an enema.
Yeah.
Enemas only clear out the last part of the lower end. So really you need to give them 12 hours or so on laxatives at the same time.
Yeah. And so back to the actual testing of constipation. So these patients, and I have seen them clinically, they bring their x-rays in, but what will sometimes happen is they'll get an x-ray of the abdomen done and you can see it. You've probably seen it before, haven't you, Dan?
Yeah.
You've seen it. It's called fecal compaction, and it's, you can trace the whole large intestine and all the way from the ileocecal valve, which is the very, very start of the colon, which is down near your right hip, all the way up the stomach, across and down to the sigmoid, which is the last part of your bowel. It just looks like sausage, basically. And it's just the whole bowel is compacted with stool.
Yeah, it looks like a fluffy, a craggy kind of speckled appearance on an x-ray.
It's very interesting to see. So I often, people will bring their x-rays in of the abdomen, and I think that should be a big factor in for testing for constipation. But what, like, if someone was to come into hospital, is there any gold standard tests you do with people, or are you just looking at the Bristol stool chart?
Yeah, people don't often come into hospital for purely constipation.
Yeah.
But if we're worried, they often get themselves a CT scan, just because if there's enough abdominal pain, we want to make sure that nothing bad has happened, such as a perforation.
Yeah.
Or even more worryingly, there's some kind of mass, like a cancer, that shouldn't be sitting there causing an obstruction. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of stuff we look to rule out in a hospital setting.
Mm.
But that's obviously not the kind of stuff that we do in the outpatient setting. Mm. Generally, I find I can get the story from the patient.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So it's all just patient questioning. Yeah. Because it's, you know what, I'm going to come back to patient questioning, because I want to talk to you about how I test my patients for constipation. And look, any patient that comes through, whether they're going 5 times a day or they're going once every 2 days, or even if they're having a bowel motion every day, I am doing a motility transit test on them. And what this is very simply put, you can jump on the Gut Biome Clinic Instagram and have a look at how to actually do the test. But you're taking 2 teaspoons of sesame seeds in a glass of water or straight in the mouth and drink it down. You want to grab your phone, start a timer, and you're looking for 3 different times. I want to know when you first start to see the seeds, when majority of the seeds start moving through and in the stool. And the last one, hopefully it's not coming up the other way, but the last one you want to look for is when you stop seeing the seeds. And that is the most important. And the reason I want to come back to the whole patient questioning is, look, I've had a patient, she was going to the bathroom every day, felt really nice and complete, had a type 4 on a Bristol stool chart. We did this motility, loads of gas, loads of bloating, but going to the bathroom every day. We did a motility test on her. It took her 10 days to pass seeds through. So she kept seeing seeds for 10 days. So I started treating her for constipation, and within 2 weeks, we completely eliminated her gas and bloating.
Yeah.
I've had a patient who's gone to the bathroom. She was going to the bathroom 7 times a day, very loose, watery, type 6 on a Bristol stool chart, did her motility challenge, didn't see any seeds for 3 days. And if, in my mind, if someone has true diarrhea, you're seeing the seeds come through and they're passing really quickly.
Yeah, generally diarrhea is a lack of absorption where the bowel doesn't have time to reabsorb all the water. And that happens in the second to last part of the bowel, in the transverse colon that goes across your stomach. And generally, if you know you're affected by an infection, you will be passing your stool too quickly to reabsorb that water, or your colon will be too inflamed to reabsorb the water.
Mm.
And generally less than 12 hours is what you get.
Yeah, and I always, that's why all my diarrhea patients, I don't always assume that it's diarrhea. I really think that not all, like some definitely have, and we'll do a whole nother session about diarrhea, but I do think some of them, it's a result as constipation. not the fecal loading that you're talking about, but there's definitely a component to it.
Yeah, because there's obviously you can get constipated in different parts of the bowel, although generally it tends to happen in the colon, in my experience with the elderly patients.
Yeah. So I really recommend everyone go home and do your motility transit test. So sesame seeds, if sesame seeds don't work, you can do it with corn. If corn doesn't work, you can also do it. We've all had the beetroot come through, but you've never had beetroot and it's happened.
Not that I've noticed.
Oh, when was the last time you had beetroot? Probably a while ago.
I don't often eat it. Yeah. But the corn, we can all recognize the corn.
Yeah, definitely we can recognize the corn. I just find with the beetroot, it's hard to find an end point to it. You see the color and then that's about it. It doesn't, it's, with the sesame seeds and the corn, it's very black and white. But for anyone at home, so what this is, the second thing is what I'm looking for is the seeds moving between, look, ideally 12 to 18 hours. So what I want is people to do the seeds at 7 o'clock at night. Ideally, I want people to do it on a Wednesday as well. I'm very prescriptive with this. I want people to do it on a Wednesday because it's the most routine day that they have. I don't want you to do it on a Friday night and then Saturday you go to the markets and do this and that and whatever. So you want to do it Wednesday night, 7 p.m. and then ideally the next morning you have an epic bowel motion and majority of those seeds move through. I'm okay for a few straggle seeds to move through in the next bowel motion, but that to me tells me that all the food that you had from the day before has now cleared your whole bowel.
And how many hours is that?
That's 12 hours.
At 12 hours.
12 hours. Well, that's 7 o'clock. Seven, you take it 7 o'clock at night, you wake 7 the next morning.
That's quite quick for what's described in the literature really as what we tend to look at.
The transit time. Yeah. But this is, I'm testing myself as well, and this is what I will do. Yeah. And I'm in this industry because I've had constipation. I'm not saying I've got the best bowels. I don't have the really fiery digestion where I'm going 3 times a day. But I know that I can very easily pass all the seeds through and then a few will come the next day. Do you remember we sat down with our family and I got everyone to do the seed transit test and we basically raced. We raced each other to see who seeds.
It was a fun thing to do for Christmas.
Yes.
Or Thanksgiving.
First date idea. Back to testing for constipation.
I just as a health safety warning there, anything less than 72 hours does not necessarily need to prompt a visit to your GP or your family doctor. It is just that in Greta's experience, she has found that it's better to be passing between 12 and 24 hours, correct?
Okay, what I would say there, if you have gas and bloating and you just feel uncomfortable and your transit time is at 72 hours, there's work that we can do. That's probably the way to say it.
Yeah.
But I think this would be my whole wish is if patients came through hospital, you test them, you question them about constipation, I would love for you to be like, here's 2 teaspoons of sesame seeds. Can you please call me when you see them? How much does that cost? It's the lowest intervention, doesn't cost anything. Because I'm really sorry, this whole, you can't leave the hospital until you have a bowel motion rule. But I remember my, actually I won't say who it was, but someone I knew was in hospital and, the doctors kept asking, have you had a bowel motion? And they would say, yes, I've passed a very small amount. It was not satisfying. They were really gassy, really bloated. And the doctor wrote that down as like, tick, yep, had a bowel motion. That's fine. Whereas it was hardly anything.
Yeah. So I think what's going on there is that people are worried that after a delivery, you either have a lot of pain down there, or your bowels have been manipulated during a C-section. Mm. And I think they just want to make sure that you can open your bowels.
Mm. Yeah.
It's probably a slightly different scenario.
Yeah. So this actually wasn't a pregnant woman. Very different age bracket.
Oh.
Anyway, moving on, can we talk about the actual treatment of it? Because I guess that's why everyone is listening. They're either got constipation, they know someone with constipation, and they want to actually know what to do with it that goes a bit further beyond let's just take a laxative, a bit of fiber, and drink some water.
Should we talk about the causes of constipation as we roll into the treatment? Because things will be different depending on the causes.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
So I think from a medical point of view, if you see a change in your bowel habit, first thing to say is this could be an important sign of something worrying. And cancer is at the forefront of everybody's mind there. It can happen in young people as well as old people. And generally, if there's a change in your bowel habit, that needs to be checked out by a doctor to see if there is a polyp, if there's a big polyp, i.e. a mass developing, or if there's some bowel cancer developing. Everybody, also please do your fecal occult blood test kits that come through the post when you hit 50. They look for tiny bits of blood in your stool. They're those free test kits. It's the simplest thing ever. All it asks is for you to put some of your stool in a pot, and it can save you a lot of hassle down the line. There's a reason that these screening programs are there, and they have been developed as being useful, as being that good that everybody gets a free one. We don't do that with every cancer, and as a fantastic way of picking things up early, which is what they're there for. So please do your screening.
Yes, do your screening.
Now, there's some other medical reasons as well. You could have perhaps problems with your thyroid, or maybe have some endometriosis or other things. So that's why it's really worth going to your GP if there's a big change in your bowel habit. The other cause, as I've already alluded to, is as we age, our bowels get lazier. They get slow, and the contraction doesn't work as well. So that can be even made worse by having problems with neurodegenerative conditions that affect the nerve cells that control your gut, such as Parkinson's disease. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not suggesting that everybody here with constipation has Parkinson's disease. It's probably not our target audience either listening to our podcasts. Although perhaps we might be surprised.
Yeah, and that's new emerging research. They're actually discussing the link between constipation and Parkinson's, and potentially coming to the conclusion that constipation can be the first sign of Parkinson's.
Yeah, it probably precedes things by about 10 years.
Yeah.
Before you start developing all the shakes and things like that. But, you know, it's so common as we age that I don't see any usefulness emerging from that anytime soon, because you could just be getting older. Any other causes of constipation, Greta?
Yeah, look, when I'm working with my constipated patients, I do try and put them into one or two categories. I look at them from a functional constipation or a mechanical constipation. And what I basically mean by that, very simply put, anything mechanical is we can't necessarily do anything about. It's they've got scar tissue, they've had a C-section, they've had hiatus hernia. There may be neurological things as well. So there's actual issues with the contraction of the muscles. So that's the mechanical cause of constipation. The flip side to that is functional causes, and they are things like changes in the microbiome, issues with digestive enzymes, could potentially be like the mind-gut connection, I think, is a big one. That's a very functional thing. And the way that I differentiate these patients is mechanical constipation. It's let's get your bowels moving and let's stay there, because there is something mechanical in the way that is impacting the movement. From a functional constipation, it's let's figure out the root cause, let's treat that and improve that. And then ideally we can move away from everything we use to treat and your gut can just do it on its own. But does that make sense?
Yes, yes it does.
Yeah.
And some of these things overlap, of course. The brain-gut axis will have some mechanical impact as well, perhaps through neural pathways, if it affects the way that your pelvis squeezes.
But I do, I often think with gut-brain access is we can improve it. We can look at nervous system, cortisol levels, those types of things.
Yeah, it's very important. The brain-gut axis will decrease your motility, decrease the way that your gut squeezes to get things from your mouth to your anus. But interestingly, there's research emerging as well that shows that the brain-gut axis weakens your gut barrier. So by having changes in the microbiome through stress or stress affecting your immunity, it will change the kind of microbes that live in your gut, and that will then change how inflamed or not your gut lining is, and that will then further affect your motility as well as even your mood.
Yeah, it's huge. When you say gut barrier, what do you mean? Are you talking about the gut lining?
Yeah, the gut lining. So obviously everything inside your body is supposed to be sterile, except everything that faces outward. So that's your skin, and that's your mouth.
Whole digestive tract.
Your whole digestive tract, which technically speaking is just a tube folded over. So your gut is not sterile. Everything else inside your body is, but your gut serves to absorb nutrients, and that goes into your bloodstream. So there's a barrier there that stops bacteria from passing through. That's the gut barrier that gets disrupted.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, and this is all this gut barrier, the motility, the mood, that brain-gut connection is all of the functional work that definitely comes into my style of work. I wish they came in more in the hospitals, but I'll get that in with my sesame seed test. Okay, should we have a chat about how to actually treat constipation? Because I think this is going to be very different depending on what industry you're working with. So Dan, do you want to run through how you guys are treating constipation in the hospitals?
Yeah, generally we use a mixture of laxatives. So you have laxatives that draw water into the bowel and make the hard stool softer. And then you have laxatives that stimulate the bowel to contract more. Generally, you want to use a stool softener if you're going to use a stimulant, so that you're not causing the bowel to squeeze against very hard stool, because what's the point in that? You'll just, you'll be squeezing bricks, as it were, which isn't very pleasant.
And what's a stool softener? Can you give us like a brand name, an example?
Yeah, so there's a few. The ones we use the most, and some of them you can get over the counter, are Lactulose, Macrogol or Movicol, picosulfate, sometimes it comes in Dulcolax drops. Some of these might be brand names. And then you have stimulants such as Senacot, you might have heard of that, or Coloxyl Sena. And we try to use a combination, so maybe a Movicol sachet. Sachets are great because you have to, by nature, take them with water, so it already helps from that point of view. So if you're really constipated, I'll give you two sachets twice a day, and I'll give you two Senacot in the evening, or maybe two twice a day as well, and then wait 12 hours. And if you're really constipated, I'll offer you an enema from the bottom end. And if that doesn't work, perhaps some of my patients aren't able to hold it in for half an hour, the water, which again just simply draws water into the hard stool in the rectum. Then a suppository does a similar trick. And that's the gold standard in which we manage all our patients with constipation.
Mm-hmm. And where does PicoPrep fit into all of that?
That's reserved for people that are not responding to the Movicol, which is really rarely.
Yeah.
A lot of these are just heavier versions of the Macrogols. And sometimes we do have to reach for that.
Yeah.
Generally, the PicoPreps are for bowel preparation, where if we're doing a colonoscopy because we're looking for something, and that could be for many reasons, not just for constipation, then we want to make sure that there is no stool left on the lining of the gut. Otherwise, we can't see worrying lesions such as little polyps or cancers. So we need to clear your colon out completely with that. And so that's some strong laxatives just for a day.
Yeah, but look, I've had so many of my patients turn around and say, like, that the Pico Prep was just the best thing that they ever did, and for once in their life they felt actually completely empty. So,
well, that's your answer right there about how constipated they are going through life.
Yeah.
Did they say anything about how that affected their well-being or their mood? Being cleared out.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. You'll often find, and this is speaking from a personal place. I remember when I was constipated, it was so much more than constipation. It's brain fog and fatigue and
it's a whole emotional constipation that comes with constipation.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's huge. It really does, really impacts things. That's usually the standard responses I'll get from the patients from hospital, and it's in hospital, it's such a difficult one because you're obviously you're lying in bed, you're bed rest, so therefore your physical movement is down, and you're usually on painkillers or you're on some type of medication that is going to impact your bowels as well. So hospital settings are just rife for constipation. Different foods as well.
Different foods, less drinking.
Yeah. Less
autonomy about reaching for water and feeling thirsty. Yeah. And you've implied one of the factors there, it's lack of movement.
Yeah.
Which is gravity and walking around. It's very important to get the gut going.
Yes, yeah. Well, they say there's three, you know what? I'm not going to remember the third one. There are three things that will actually trigger you to go, like a bowel motion to go. One of them is waking up. So waking up in the day, cortisol, your circadian rhythm starts. The second one is eating something. So actually eating something, and that triggers peristalsis. And when you'll hear us say peristalsis a lot, but it's that wave-like contractions of the muscles moving. As soon as you start chewing, your gut's like, okay, there's food coming. Let's start those contractions. And the third thing is movement. Movement is a huge prokinetic. It's a huge trigger to actually get that gut moving. So I always say to patients, if you're not moving, you can't expect your gut to move either.
Yeah. And sometimes you can see a combination of all three. There's been some famous incidents of marathon runners. I'm thinking of one British marathon runner. Paula Radcliffe, who famously, had to defecate in the middle of a race, which obviously isn't very glamorous when you're wearing very, very skimpy outfits. And I'm afraid to say this might have followed her whole career. But that's the nature of what happens when you are, one, running, two, cortisol is firing, and three, perhaps you're taking on supplements that are pure glucose.
Glucose, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, do you want me to run through what I do with my patients? Because it's very different. Yeah. I'm obviously getting the population of people who they've done the hospital stint, they're now dealing with constipation day in, day out, and it's been like this for 10, 15 years. So this is how I address my patients. So first of all, we need to get you on a motility agent. And I don't mind what that motility agent is looking like. Dan mentioned before that there's different types of laxatives. You can use an osmotic laxative or a stimulant laxative. In my opinion, a stimulant laxative can be quite cramping and quite uncomfortable for people, and that's your Senna. I think people have had experiences with that just causing a lot of abdominal pain. So I much prefer using an osmotic laxative, and that is like the Movicol that Dan was talking about.
Yeah, I agree. Somebody who's constipated, don't chuck just a stimulant at them.
Yeah.
And often people will do that because it's the one they can get very freely over the counter.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. And it's like when people are really constipated, they will go for that Coloxyl Senna mix. But, you know, also I find if people are this, and this came very early on in my treatment of constipation, I find if people are that constipated and they'll say that I try Movicol and Senna and Coloxyl and I'm really high doses and nothing's moving. What I often find is if you actually go, so you go from the bottom up, and this is pun unintended, but I have no other way of saying this. So you are taking your laxatives orally and you're trying to get the bowels moving basically at the other end of the body. If nothing is moving and you're taking all your laxatives, what I actually recommend for patients is to do a glycerin suppository, which is a tiny little bullet that you put up the rectum and you hold it in there for about 20 minutes. And hopefully that releases what we call the fecal plug, which is that very, very hard bit of stool. Once that is released, then go for all of your other stimulant osmotic laxatives.
I use them at the same time because of the delay that you'll get anyway in taking the laxatives orally.
But from a patient point of view, it's very rarely, very rarely I'm bringing in suppositories. But from a typical patient, I really like to get them on a magnesium citrate or a magnesium glycate. Now, this is important. I want them on some type of either one of those magnesiums. I want them at a 400 milligram dose. I want them to take it at night and I need it to be a powder form. I've had a lot of patients who have taken the same dose at the same time as the other patients, but it's the powder form that is very easily absorbed and it actually gets the results happening. So I use that first. You use a motility agent to begin with to get the bowels moving. The gut loves routine and rhythm and it needs that constant routine and rhythm to actually continue and to get moving. So I do that and I want at least 2 months of a really good bowel motion every single day. Once we can achieve that, I actually then move on to a prokinetic. And I mentioned before, a prokinetic is something that squeezes the bowel in this kind of rhythmic-like contraction. A prokinetic that I love to use is Iberogast is a really great one. There's an amazing product called Motil Pro. And it's a very odd dose. It's 3 capsules in the morning and it's things like ginger, artichoke, off the top of my head, I can't remember them now. There's also, script like medicine prokinetics you can get. What are the names of them, Dan?
Yeah, Maxilon, which is metoclopramide. You can also get clarithromycin, which is an antibiotic or erythromycin, the same class, antibiotics with prokinetic properties.
So it has an antibiotic component to it?
They are antibiotics that just happen to have prokinetic properties.
Oh, you probably wouldn't want to impact the microbiome in that way.
No. Yeah. Which is where Maxilon metoclopramide comes in.
So we use the osmotic laxative or the magnesium citrate to create that osmotic effect. So pulling the water into the bowel. Once we get those bowel motions moving, we move on to a prokinetic. So actually helping with the contractions of the muscle moving. Once we've got those two working and there's an amazing bowel motion happening every day, this is a really good time that I'll retest people's transit time and get them at that 12 hours. This is when I bring in a fiber. And a fiber is always a really big conversation about constipation because a lot of my patients will bring in something like a Metamucil or a psyllium husk or a slippery elm. And feel awful from it because there's too much fiber for them to actually digest and process. So my recommendation is do not bring a fiber supplement in until you've actually got the bowels moving. So once we've got all 3 of them on board, we've got the magnesium, the prokinetic and a fiber, and we're still getting that good complete bowel motion. That's when I look at potentially coming off that magnesium or titrating down, which means starting to take smaller and smaller doses. And ideally, the whole aim of this is to come off the magnesium and the prokinetic and just stay on some type of fiber. The idea as well is while we're doing that whole protocol, I'm also really onto food as medicine and the movement side of things. When I'm talking about food as medicine, I mean being very honest with the foods that are serving you and not serving you, and trying to maybe remove some food groups for a little bit and bring them back in. Also making sure people are actually ingesting enough food and enough fiber. And then from the movement side of thing as well is just making sure people are moving every single day.
Can you talk a bit more about the food? Are you saying you go and look at what everybody eats and your recommendations are different for everybody?
Yes. Yeah. Because no one's the same. Sometimes it's dairy for people. Sometimes it's gluten. Sometimes I find that they're eating too much fiber and that's causing issues. So I will sometimes pull people's fiber down until we get it, their bowels moving, and then I'll increase it.
But the majority of people say don't eat enough fiber.
Yeah. And I've also had some patients as well that just don't eat enough in general.
And when you say fiber, just to make it clear for the audience, what do you mean? What foods have fiber?
Look, I think we're all conditioned to think that fiber is like your pastas and your whole grains and your breads. But what I am envisioning here is your plant fibers. So fruit fiber, a whole lot of range of veggies, lentils, chickpeas. They're the type of fibers I'm talking about. Your rices.
So people need to eat more fruit and vegetables.
Yeah. That would be
a great way to do it.
Yeah. They found out, they did a study and found that majority of people are eating 10 to 15 grams of fiber a day. The recommended dose is 30 grams. And I think people should be up at 40 to 45 grams, definitely.
And what kind of fiber is this? The kind of non-soluble or the soluble type of fibers?
Combination of both. That's what I want.
And what about these breakfast cereals like bran that that they have all this fiber in it?
Oh, I just have nothing to say about that. And it's just, you know what, I think it's amazing marketing. That's probably what I have to say about that. I think it's, I know my nan definitely grew up eating all bran so that she'd have a good bowel motion and Special K.
This podcast is not sponsored by Kellogg's.
Yeah, obviously. It's just eat your plants and eat your plant fibers, your fruit fibers.
I know your opinion about the brands. Can you tell us what the problem is with them?
Oh, they're just so highly processed. Like, they're so far away from what natural food could be. Like, you eat oats every morning. That's a natural product. Like, that's amazing.
And do I remember that there's lots of sugar in the bran as well, or have I made it up?
No, there's definitely carbohydrates, yes. Depends. Like, sugar, Special K will have a lot of sugar, a lot. And yes, we're now getting into having huge amounts of sugar to start your day. All bran, I'm pretty sure, has no sugar, but it is just all highly processed carbohydrates. To be honest, I don't even know what the base ingredient in it is.
Yeah.
So look, like, if you're eating all bran, and this is not us digging into you if you're eating all bran, but it is my biggest recommendation. If oats work well with you, please just make that simple switch and just move to whole. What do you eat? Rolled oats?
Yes, I do. I don't even make porridge with them. I have
just
eat
rolled oats. Yeah. That's his breakfast he's had for 15 years. And
breakfast of champions.
Whatever I can do, I just cannot. I cannot change that.
Well, I throw in some nuts as well, and they have fiber in.
And some berries. They were my introduction. But look, to give you a case study, I had a patient who, very interesting, she was very sensitive to any supplement. She had, a lot of allergies and intolerances. And so she was my first patient where I had to get her bowels moving purely with food as medicine. And this is my exact prescription. I gave her 2 kiwi fruits a day. I gave her half a dragon fruit. And I gave her a mix of 1 tablespoon of chia seeds, 1 tablespoon of flaxseed meal in a glass of water. And I let her sit that for 10 minutes and then drink that down. I also did a big analysis of her diet and found that she actually was not, she was eating extremely well, but she wasn't actually eating enough food. So we bought in things like sweet potatoes and pumpkins and like just started to bring up that starch and that bulkiness of food so we could bulk up her stool. And yeah, very surprisingly, well, we got her to a point where she was having a great bowel motion every day, and it was just so rewarding.
And why were you getting those seeds to sit in water for a bit? What's the idea?
The idea is, look, chia seeds are great on their own, but we want to bulk the seeds up, and we want to create some bulk in the stool to actually get movement happening. The way I envision it is if people take just raw chia seeds, it's soaking up the water that's in the stomach and in the digestive system, which is potentially dehydrating people even more.
So you're really filling it up with water before you ingest them.
Yeah. And you know, when you soak chia seeds, they get that, we call it like a mucilagin, like just a slimy layer
jelly,
to it.
Jelly-like, yeah.
Amazing fiber, amazing movement for the gut. Ideally that your bowel holds on to that hydration as well.
Now, I heard you drop another fruit in there, which is very interesting. The kiwi fruit.
Oh, yes.
And in the last few years, there's been some interesting studies about kiwi fruit.
Yeah.
I'd love to talk a bit more about that.
So cool to see food as medicine studies being done on kiwi fruits.
So both green and gold kiwi fruits are very high in dietary fiber. They're also full of other things like vitamin C and folic acid and antioxidants. But there seems to be something special about the kiwis, and that's that they have this special enzyme called actinidin, which seems to be very good at giving antimicrobial protection to the plant itself, the kiwi fruit, and it's able to enhance the digestion of beef and dairy and wheat. And apparently the actinidin seems to also accelerate your gastric emptying, so there's some prokinetic properties to it. And it might even change your pain reception and anti-inflammatory response of the gut through some other receptors, protease activator receptors. So there's this study that we found by Richard Geary and others in 2023, where they tested about 60 patients each that were healthy and some people that had irritable bowel syndrome with constipation. Mm. And they found that the people who ate 2 green kiwis a day had huge improvements in their symptom rating, and their complete bowel motions increased by more than 1.5 a week.
Can I ask a question here?
Yeah.
Is this skin on or skin off?
Yeah, so...
always up for debate.
That was not clear in the study. I couldn't find any description on that.
Yeah.
I know what I do now. I eat it with the skin.
Yes.
and that might freak people out, but why not have the extra fiber that's in the skin? And also, it saves me from having to get up and chuck it in the bin.
So sustainable of you.
Thank you. A similar study was repeated with 2 gold kiwis a day with, again, similar outcomes, but with way less patients. And we'll put the link in the description of the podcast. One word of caution, this was partially sponsored by Zespri, as well as the New Zealand Aotearoa government. So did that affect their findings? I'm not sure. I'm from Belgium, and my mum swears by kiwis and has ever since I grew up.
Yeah.
She thinks they're amazing to get going in the morning.
Yeah. She's onto something, because this kiwi stuff it's only been in the last, I'd say, 12 months, don't you think?
Yeah, a bit more, 24 months. Yeah. That the research really has caught caught on to this. They should have been speaking to my mum way earlier.
Yeah, yeah. Could have fixed a whole lot of constipated people out there.
That's right.
But my gosh, it honestly is one of the first times. Like, it's funny that you say now that it was sponsored by Zespri. If anyone doesn't know, Zespri is like a common kiwi fruit brand. And it's like a lot of other medical drug things are all sponsored by Big Pharma. And
yeah, and let's be pragmatic. The only way to do this study is to get sponsorship.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you will just, once again, have small studies that are of no value statistically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I also was talking about studies and constipation. There was also a really interesting one on probiotics for constipation. And there was a study done back in 2008, looking at, this is very specific here, a very specific form, strain of probiotic, but Bifidobacterium lactis DN173101. And what we're finding now in the new research is, sure, we can have Bifidobacterium, which is, it's a very broad way of describing what a bacteria is, but we're actually finding, like, as I mentioned, DN173010, that it's very specific to what action it actually does in the digestive tract or modulating the microbiome. But they found that in constipated women who ingested DN173010, they all had significant improvements in bowel frequency after 1 week, which I think is that's a pretty quick turnaround.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
And that was in this Bifidobacterium drink with some kind of yogurt, wasn't it?
Yeah, yep. So it was I forget the name of it, but they basically culture their own yogurt with this specific strain in it.
So fermented milk.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a big study, and it seems like it's well executed. So.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it comes back down to, you know, altering what bacteria live in your gut, which will alter how your bowel behaves.
So can we move on to a topic about, look, if you've done all the testing, you've done all your seed testing, you've done your colonoscopy, your endoscopy, and they're not finding anything, where else does your mind go? What are the last clues that you're looking for or things that you're thinking out about that you would like to get further tested?
Personally, I start thinking about things such as pelvic floor dysfunction,
yes,
as well as extreme anxiety or stress impacting the motility.
Interesting.
And then, of course, you also wonder about whether there are the nerve endings to the enteric gut system are affected by something like diabetes.
Yeah. Can we go back to pelvic floor? Talk to us about that, because this is so important and so overlooked.
Yeah, look, this is way outside of my own scope. I would refer to a pelvic floor specialist that deals with constipation. We do have a few locally here in New South Wales, including in Newcastle. There's a gastroenterologist, Magnus Harland, who's excellent at trying to work on the pelvic floor and dysmotility to make sure that you coordinate the emptying of your bowel correctly.
Mm. And this is something called dysinergic constipation. And I was just, look, my interest with the gut is the motility. So how do we actually move stool and food through? Like, I'm mind blown that the gut just does that on its own. Dysinergic constipation is when this doesn't happen. And it's what Dan is talking about. And it's when, well, I'm sure there can be so many different expressions of it, but they, one that they often talk about is when people have constipation after a long period of time, what happens is when they go to the bathroom, they actually strain quite a lot. And that straining causes the rectum, the last circular muscle in the bowel, to squeeze, close, and basically shut like pursed lips, like just a cat's bum.
Just at the wrong moment when it needs to open.
Yes, yeah. And so what's happening is your pelvic floor is trying to push down and get a stool moving, and your butthole is super tight. So it's, I guess, what's an analogy? It's like trying to squeeze toothpaste through a toothpaste opening that has clogged up with all the toothpaste.
Yes, same.
I did that this morning, and it was so hard for me to get the toothpaste
Oh,
out.
we're still talking about toothpaste.
Yes. But that's dyssynergic constipation, and I actually have shown people this, and it's almost a light bulb moment for them because they have just spent the last 10 years of their life going red in the face and just turning on every muscle just to get a bowel moving. And it is this discoordination, or this, is that a word?
Discoordination,
Discoordination of the muscles actually moving the stool through.
and with simple retraining, they can retrain how to do this.
And the way to actually test it is a rectal examination. And so what this means is a practitioner, a doctor, GP, gastroenterologist, would place a finger in the rectum and would get the patient to squeeze around the finger. And if the patient couldn't squeeze in the right area, then it's a real true sign of that dyssynergic constipation.
Yeah, and I think most GPs would feel uncomfortable at a rectal examination that's that detailed,
Yes.
just due to a lack of experience of what it feels like to have dyssynergic contractions. And generally, a gastroenterologist would be better,
Yeah.
or even better, a motility specialist at
Yes.
detecting this.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I might run through a few things that I often think about. So I'm always looking for thyroid function, so hypothyroidism. So I'd love to know what's happening with like TSH, T3, T4, which is an in-depth thyroid panel. Pelvic floor is another one I'm looking at, and I'm often referring to pelvic floor physios. And I've worked gotten really great results in combination with a pelvic floor physio. Inactivity, you'll hear me say, if the bowels aren't moving, sorry, if you're not moving, you can't expect the bowels to move. So I'm always questioning about people's movement and what it's looking like, and is it a daily thing?
And we're not talking about running marathons like Paula Radcliffe
Definitely
here, are
not.
we?
Definitely
What
not.
are we talking about?
Just look, moving the body daily. And if I was to be prescriptive about it, 45 minutes minimum daily. You know, I read an amazing
Are we
quote.
walking,
Oh
running?
yeah, just walking. Walking. Look, if you're physically unable, even yoga, stretching the abdomen, doing like spinal twists, doing cat cow movements is amazing to just get the gut moving. But a quote that has always stayed with me is not engaging in more than an hour of physical activity a day is considered high risk activity. And I just loved it. I thought it just put everything on its head, basically saying how high risk it is for us to not be
Yeah,
physically
which is
active.
most of us.
Yeah.
You get in your car to commute, you don't walk.
Yeah.
You sit at a desk, you don't walk.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. And as Dan and I sit here with broken toes and sore feet, we're not walking at the moment. Other things that I'm looking at is actually surprisingly sticky stools, so not digesting the fat. I find if it's sticky coming out, it's usually sticky around the bowel wall, sometimes causing constipation. And so I'll sometimes think about actually supporting them to digest their fat through an enzyme or through bitters. Under eating is another thing I think about. We look, the whole bowel is working by actually moving food through the digestive tract. So if you're not eating, if you're skipping meals, or if you're eating very small, like a sparrow eater is what people often say, that's often something that can cause that constipation and that slow motility. And as Dan was mentioning before, that mind-gut connection, so that nervous system component. There is one last thing I wanted to talk about, and this is something that, oh, I wonder if you've ever heard about it. Have you heard of the migrating motor complex, the MMC?
I have.
Okay, what do you know about it?
I don't know much about it.
The migrating motor complex is, think of it as like, it's almost like another way of describing peristalsis. It's this kind of sweeping like motion of the gut moving and us moving bacteria through and actually getting the bowels moving.
Yeah.
SIBO is so unbelievably common in, well, I don't know, your industry doesn't
what,
really.
What's SIBO?
Sorry, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth.
Yeah.
Just for the listeners. I've been to a lot of gastro conferences and they don't think that SIBO is a thing.
No, we think it is a thing, whether it's a chicken or an egg.
Yes.
That's the question.
Yeah, yeah. And I've actually done some really cool studies on it recently, and they're actually, this is a conversation for another time, but they're saying it's so much more, there's so much more involved in SIBO than just small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. But a common side effect from SIBO, if we have a methane dominant SIBO picture going on, is we can get a disruption to the migrating motor complex, which basically means we get a reduction in peristalsis causing constipation. And this then comes back to the chicken or the egg. Is did the constipation happen because of the migrating motor complex and the SIBO, or is the SIBO as a result of the constipation?
And that's what's our job,
yeah.
You and I, to figure out.
Yeah, and we're doing it. I have two questions for you, mm-hmm. just before we finish up. I want to know, is a lazy bowel a real thing?
Yeah, I think it's a catch-all term for a slow bowel, for all the reasons that we mentioned before. So yes, it is a thing. Is it fixable? It depends what the cause is. If it's unchangeable things that have been going on for a long time, such as severe diabetes or advanced age or heralding Parkinson's disease, then unfortunately that won't be so fixable. But still, the treatment's the same. You try and optimize every other factor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. I just hear people come back from their gastros and they've been told they have a lazy bowel and maybe I haven't done the research or the study about it, but in my opinion, that's just constipation and there's stuff that we can do. Because those patients, yes. I have gotten them to a point where they're going to the bathroom daily.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a bit of a cop out to dismiss somebody with a lazy bowel. There's
right.
lots of things that can be done.
Yeah.
As you've heard.
Yeah. And so then on that topic as well, what about long bowel? Often people come back and say that I've had a diagnosis of long bowel.
Yeah.
Is that a real anatomical thing?
It is. And it is a problem. So we'll get patients who've had severe constipation. And often there is some neurological reasons such as learning disability or dementia, and they have let their constipation go on for too long, or it's been mismanaged for some reason or the other for a long time.
Mm.
And unfortunately, their colon will elongate. It will become longer. It will become floppier. You have your sigmoid, which is the last part just before your rectum, where you're supposed to store your feces up until the moment that you are near a toilet and you're happy to release your bowel motion. That will get bigger, that will become huge, and as you can imagine, that will then impact on how well that bowel will squeeze.
Mm-hmm.
So we absolutely want to get there before this happens, because otherwise it becomes extremely challenging to manage this with the usual agents.
So you're not born with a long bowel?
No. No.
Because I've had a few patients say, oh, my mum had a long bowel, I've got a long bowel.
Look,
it's not a genetic thing?
There might be genetic predisposing factors, but I'm not sure any studies have been done to compare this.
Mm.
Generally, people, when we do colonoscopies, have roughly similar length of bowels.
Mm.
It's more or less a factor of their size.
Mm-hmm.
So how much space is in their abdomen, either in stature or in terms of how big the lungs and the diaphragm and everything is, that can start making an impact over time rather than, oh, I was born this way.
Yeah, Sure. Yeah. Okay. All right. Should we wrap things up then with a bit of a take home, some take home
Yeah.
advice? Yeah. Do you want me to run through the take
Go
homes?
for it.
So my biggest take home as a practitioner that works with all of these patients who have been through it before, this is my absolute area of interest. Get your bowels moving first in whatever way that you possibly can. Once you've gotten that to a really good place, make sure you implement the diet and the lifestyle work, and then ideally you can start to come off whatever motility agent you are using. Number one, you cannot expect your gut to move if you aren't moving yourself. So what this is can be anywhere from gentle to running or whatever style of training you're capable of or enjoy doing. Do it for at least an hour every single day.
And one thing we haven't talked about there is the fact that stress will just impact constipation.
Yeah.
If you then start changing your lifestyle and
Yeah.
incorporating more movement in it, including exercise,
It does have that knock-on effect.
in several ways. So
Yeah.
reducing your stress by having exercise
Yeah.
and prioritizing your movement, which
Yeah.
will improve your constipation in all
Yeah,
those ways.
yeah. Yeah, and I think the last thing is it's important to say that look, constipation, long-standing constipation can have complications further down the track, and a lot of my patients have just put up with it for 20 years, and there's so much new information out there about digestion. And look, lowest hanging fruit, have two kiwis a day. It's the most minimal intervention that you can do. But I just want to sit here and say that there is so much we can do for constipation, and it's not something that you just need to put up with.
No, because putting up with it is a symptom of emotional constipation.
All right, thank you so much for joining us on this topic about everything to do with constipation.
Next time, we will be talking about evidence-based medicine.
Look forward to chatting then.
See ya.
The Gut Bio Podcast.